Good afternoon, everyone. This is Rob Raccoon.
Howdy.
Howdy. Good. Well, it's 3:30 here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on a cold and gray, overcast day. We're loving the potential for moisture, since we sorely need it. It's probably about 20 degrees out, and it's not the slush and ice that the East Coast has received, but I guess we're all grateful for whatever moisture we get. Certainly out here in the West, we are. This is the quarterly call-in telephone tea, not a very elegant name, but we do serve tea and coffee and cookies here in the office in Santa Fe, and I try and cover the same material that I generally do in the personal tea on these telephone calls, so that clients and interested people can call in later and hear the same general economic overview that people in Santa Fe get when they come to our office. So, what I'll probably do is talk for about half an hour. I try not to stop too many times, and then we'll open the floor up to questions. People can email me questions during the course of the first half hour, or just jump in at the end. We are at the end of a period of a long stock market rise that has occurred primarily because people can't think of anything else to do with their money. The Federal Reserve has increased the balance sheet, amount of bonds that have been created to support the balance sheets of the banks, to the tune of $4 trillion. And banks around the world, the central banks, have become the key players on the economic scene, primarily in the financial markets. And this is a very important phenomena. It's quite unheard of before now, when the central government has become a key player in the world stock markets. Before this, the governments tried to stay out of the stock market. They tried to not be concerned or swayed by the stock market. But what people realized just leading up to and after the meltdown in 2007 and 2008 is that, by and large, people's confidence level and therefore their spending habits were dictated to primarily by their feelings of wealth, which was determined by what they perceived to be the value of their home and the value of their retirement or stock portfolio, if they're lucky enough to have them. And that the great majority of high-end consumer purchases and consumer discretionary spending accounts for about 70% of the U.S. economy. And so the new logic was that the financial markets dictate the real economy, as opposed to vice versa, where the real economy, if it's thriving, leads to a strong financial market. Now we're in, for the last 5 years, 6 years now, a situation where the financial markets are the key, and it is the primary focus of the central banks around the world to influence the confidence level of investors. Because what we've seen, and what we'll be talking about here in a minute, is primarily the ineffectual nature of central bank policy on the real economy. It certainly has driven the cost of financial assets up, which is great for people with the value of financial assets up, great for people with portfolios, great for people who bought real estate, because we have over and over since the late 1990s seen the government step in and purposely prop up the markets with central bank activity. I have and showed a few charts, which I can't really do on the telephone, but in some ways it'll be easier for you all to follow. The general rule of thumb, based on about 120 years of economic analysis, is that when a country's debt to gross domestic product ratio, that means the amount of money that's been borrowed by the government and individuals and corporations compared to the annual output of the economy, gets above the range of 260 to 275%, then there is a actual decrease in economic activity. Remember, the whole purpose of the stimulus program is to increase economic activity. We're in a period where U.S. economic activity is subpar. It's positive, more positive than Europe and much of the rest of the world, other than China and some parts of Asia. We're at about a rate of 3%. Now, 4% is considered to be a recovery, a typical recovery. So we're not even yet back into a normal recovery, even though we're in positive economic growth. But the question is, all of this stimulus that has pushed up the price of stocks and bonds by and large for the last 10 years, has that helped the real economy? And so we look at the ratio of public and private debt, and we see that the U.S. is the only time when it was above that danger level of, let's say, 275% was during the Depression. That is the years like 1933 through 38. And then it rapidly came down even through World War II when the country was borrowing money, savings bonds, and all of that. And that the level of debt did not get back up into a danger level until the mid-2000s, when the banks were going crazy with real estate loans, and Alan Greenspan thought it was no problem. And now, presently, we're at a ratio of about 350%. The meaning of that is that all of the central bank activity in the world is now depressing economic activity rather than stimulating it. It's been stimulating the price of stocks, but depressing job creation and manufacturing activity, et cetera. So there's a disconnect going on. And for the past couple of years, with the stock market going up the way it has, most people that aren't looking for jobs really didn't care about what kind of effect this stimulative program was having on the real economy. It's only if you're the one out of six white males in the U.S. are out of work and have been out of work for over 2 years. That is, white males between the ages of 18 and 50, one out of six are unemployed. That doesn't even begin to talk about the numbers of people under the age of 30 who are permanently looking at kind of underemployment opportunities due to the retraction in real economic activity. Or if you're, you know, black or Hispanic or uneducated, basically without a college education, your prospects are much dimmer statistically. I just got back from a trip to New York and North Carolina and briefly South Carolina. So I'm drinking a little coffee. I may be a little more amped up than normal. That may be a good or a bad thing. Who knows? But I love the coffee back east, and I'm not yet weaned here back in Santa Fe. So what we have is very high government and private debt relative to economic activity. Other indicators that this is the case is that the money that has been created is sitting in the central banks' vaults or on the books of banks, and it's not going out into new business loans. It was going into residential loans, multifamily loans, as both of those housing markets showed really very strong economic performance up through the second half of 2013, and now even those markets are falling off. Maybe not in places like Asheville or Brooklyn or San Francisco, but by and large over the country, that is the case, that real estate activity has gone down. The mortgage rates have gone up substantially. All of the government debt out there is making people nervous. No one has any clue how it's going to come back into the statistical norm or revert to the statistical mean, which is generally what things do. But money is sitting idle. It's not getting into the real economy. And so that presents a number of challenges for us as investors. Is what do we do with money, with cash, in an environment when interest rates have been suppressed, when the central banks are very upfront about their intent to continue to keep interest rates very, very low, close to zero, for an extended period of time going out into the future? What can an investor do who is not a sort of a go-go aggressive gambler type, but just a long-term saver or a retiree who wants to live off the income off their portfolio? It is a very challenging environment, much more challenging than I have seen ever before, because you have this huge government player sitting in the ring and basically calling the shots, at least as far as short-term interest rates are going. So the intent is that interest rates will stay very low until unemployment goes down, regardless of whether you unemployment statistics you look at. They're pretty much garbage. The unemployment rate now is supposed to be 7% in the U.S. I think that's garbage. There are many, many people, hundreds of thousands, if not a million people, who have just stopped looking for work. And as they fall off the statistics, the unemployment level can go down, but there can be more people who want and need work, which I think is the case today. People have just given up because the jobs aren't there, and it's quite likely that they won't be there for several reasons. So the prospect for employment is not necessarily good for the regular person, the sort of middle management and on down, the non-technical person. That means that wages are unlikely to go up. We'll talk more about deflation in a little bit, but the investment challenge that we're dealing with has to do with, in a consistently low interest rate environment, what do you do? People have gone into stocks. That's what they've done. That's why the stock market has gone up. There are not really even talking about the current sort of short-term retracement in the market, which isn't even really technically a correction yet. Companies are not making money because they're expanding in size. They're making money because they're laying off people. They're buying more computers to take the place of people to increase their productivity, at least on paper. And they're also buying back their own shares, which is all a way of saying that stock prices are going up, but not necessarily because the companies are thriving, that they're gaining market share, that they're making innovations. So that may well be close to an end. There's only so long that you can take those kinds of tactics and report increased earnings. And I think we'll see decreased corporate earnings over the next year, and the kind of assumption that stocks are going to have another double-digit year is, I think, quite likely to be proved wrong. But then again, I've been wrong often in the past to myself. So I'm not taking a holier than thou position over any other of the market pundits. There are many reasons why inflation, which is something that most people who are over, let's say, 50, assume is the underlying characteristic of the economy, that interest rates have got to go up because they're just too darn low. Well, I think that's true because interest rates should be at a rate of inflation plus a nominal rate of return of something like 1% to 2%, so that there's a reason why investors put their money in savings accounts and have some real rate of return. Because reported inflation is very low, and in fact, many prices of manufactured goods are down, wages are down, even oil prices are down because of the energy glut, the sort of resurgence of the U.S. Energy market, primarily natural gas, but also other kinds of oil, that inflation is probably running about 2 or 3%, which means that interest rates should be around 4 or 5%, and they're really at 2 or 3%. So you have a disconnect, about a 2% disadvantage, which is substantial when you're looking at living off your portfolio for the next 20 or 30 years as a retiree or as a professional investor. There's a disconnect between the rate of interest, the rate of inflation, and then what's likely to happen with the performance of these investments. So what I mean by that is that the U.S. market, the U.S. bond market, has done very, very well and will probably continue to do well. Even the U.S. government bond market, no matter what the size of our deficit, no matter how off the charts it looks, no matter how much money the banks are keeping or what the real rate of unemployment is, the U.S. remains a safe haven, and investors are fleeing literally the markets where they're just not comfortable, the emerging markets in South America, in Asia, and putting money in the U.S., some money in Europe, even though Europe is in from an objective standpoint, terrible, terrible financial condition, far worse than us. I have another chart that shows the relative level of indebtedness of countries versus each other, and the most highly indebted nation on the planet is Japan, by far. They have more government liabilities, twice as many as the U.S. does as a percentage of their economic output. The U.S. is pretty much tied with England and France. Germany is in better shape, and the European countries as a whole are pretty much neck and neck with the U.S. Very interesting that Japan, the most highly indebted nation in the world, also has the worst demographics. They have the lowest birth replacement rate. They have the strictest immigration policy. They have the highest energy costs. But you know what? It's so amazing. It's apparently, like, other than the fallout from the Fukushima power plant disaster, it's like one of the best places in the world to live. The quality of life, people are affluent in Japan. Just because their future isn't looking so bright doesn't mean that they don't have a really, really high quality of life right now. Very kind of a curious juxtaposition of future and present statuses. France, one other interesting statistic, at least I found it interesting, is that relative to the entire world's economic output, the size of the world's economy, the U.S. makes up 1/4 of the world's economy. Europe combined, the 15 countries in Europe, is about the same size as the U.S. So together, Europe and the U.S. are half the world's economy. The other half is Japan makes up about 10%, China about 10%, and then the other nations in the world combined make up the remaining 30%. So that gives you an idea of the relative sizes of the economy and the relative sizes of the debt. No one can really speak to how big China's debt is. The Chinese government basically controls all the money in the country, and so it's and they have huge amounts of U.S. dollar bills, U.S. Currency reserves. They own a tremendous amount of U.S. debt. So they have quite a bit of latitude in what they do economically. They're kind of a world unto themselves. So back to the investment picture and the challenge facing us in these kinds of markets where we have ultra-low interest rates. We have companies likely to be reporting lowered earnings, at least year-over-year earnings reports. This year's 2014's earnings will likely be lower than 2013 unless they are able to pull another a rabbit out of the hat, which is always possible given the extremely adept accounting abilities of people that work for big business. The U.S. economy is not necessarily providing a big boost to any of the companies. We're, as I said before, we're in kind of a slow growth, slow inflation period, and consumers are just not stepping up to the plate in any very big way. A lot of economists feel that U.S. consumers, by and large, understand, especially the mass of people, the baby boom generation that's moving towards retirement, just starting to enter into the retirement years, many of them realize that they just haven't saved enough to maintain their standard of living, at least not to live off the interest or earnings on their investment portfolio. So they know they're going to have to use up their capital. And many baby boomers are realizing that they're going to have to work far longer than they thought or previously. And oftentimes, for people who've lost their jobs, have to work two or three part-time jobs. So all of that is a way of saying that the general engine of the U.S. economy, consumer spending, is unlikely to come back in any way, shape, or form like it existed before the financial meltdown. Now, people have asked, what about the real estate market? How's that doing? And when we get to talking about the investment strategies that we believe in that are best suited to deal with these kind of sort of challenging issues, the real estate market is very much of a local market. There are some areas of the country that are just hitting home runs in real estate. If you're in San Francisco, you're just, you know, sort of lucky if you've got a house, and if you don't have a house yet, you're just out of luck. Houston, Dallas, the energy industry is booming, and so real estate is doing well in those areas. Of course, New York City, Miami are magnets for an international crowd that's bringing money from activity overseas, Central South America. Of course, the Arabs bring a lot of their oil money to the U.S. and to London in particular, and the London real estate market is going crazy. The market in Brooklyn, where we have a project going, is sort of beyond belief because Manhattan is just too darn expensive. The prices in Manhattan are like $2,000 a square foot for property. So if you can pick up property in Brooklyn for $600, $700 a square foot, it sounds expensive from the point of view of sane Americans who live in other parts of the nation except for San Francisco, where prices are probably similar. But a lot of the country, the country's real estate market, and I look at a lot of real estate because we look at a lot of private investments in real estate, the parts of the country that have relied on second homes for working class people or professionals is very much still in the doldrums. That includes Santa Fe as well. People that build second homes, energy inefficient homes that require a lot of travel to get to, a lot of maintenance. Those real estate markets are unlikely, I think, ever to come back. And people are asking me all the time, should they sell their home in this environment or that environment because they're not using that and they wonder whether the markets are coming back. By and large, if the market hasn't already come back, it ain't coming back. And I had that conversation with someone outside of Asheville last week in a kind of a high-end housing development. He is waiting for the market to come back, and about 20 miles down the road in the city of Asheville, in a certain price area, the market is booming, and he's in the high end of the market, like a lot of people, you know, that whole kind of suburban expansion of America is, I won't say it's over, but there's a great movement towards of people that want to drive less, that want to be able to walk to the supermarket, to their movie theater, to their coffee shop. And so if you have a safe urban environment that has some cultural attractions, those areas are rebounding, whereas the exurbs, the ones that take an hour to drive to, are hurting and unlikely to regain their value. A lot of areas of California that require long commutes, I think those values are not going to ever come back. So there's a lot of readjustment in real estate, which is where many Americans have much of their personal net worth, as well as in the equity markets, where you've got this great kind of surge in valuation due to the great bulge of public money, of government money coming in and essentially refinancing the American banks. Now, Europe is undergoing the same kind of process, maybe condensed, because it was only about 18 months ago or 2 years ago that the European Central Bank essentially said, we are done trying to be protectors against inflation to enforce fiscal discipline. We are going to backstop every bank in the European Union. Essentially, that's what Ben Bernanke said in 2008, and he did it. He did it by insuring all deposits. He did it by allowing junk securities to be used as if they had the same value as U.S. Treasuries did or cash. And there are lots of ways that the financial institutions have of sort of gerrymandering their books so that they look in much better shape than they did the day before, even though it's just kind of a sleight of hand, the accounting tricks. And that has by and large worked because people do have confidence in the banks again. I don't think there's any great love for the banks out there. And it's fascinating to me that when you read in the newspaper, which if, you know, you open up the newspaper anytime in the last 6 months and there's every other day there's a story about a $500 million fine or a $1.2 billion fine against some kind of great manipulation, whether it's LIBOR or interest rates or a fraud case about the pricing of mortgage securities. It's unbelievable. And these billion-dollar fines against banks are a sham. They're because the government essentially funneled hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks to shore up their balance sheets so that people wouldn't lose faith in the system. They're now kind of sorting it out and making it look like there's some kind of justice being done, but it's purely window dressing and PR. The banks are definitely subject to the government's dictates, and the government has decided, rightly or wrongly, it's not for me to say, that the banks and I'm talking about the investment banks now, the big ones, Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, really are essential to the economy, and it's okay if those guys make, you know, a couple of $10 million, and they kind of drill down on the little guy. At least the markets are not rife with worry about whether they're going to survive or not. Nobody worries about the banks anymore. They don't even worry about the European banks. And the European banks are woefully undercapitalized, probably to the tune of about $1 trillion, which is maybe a meaningless number if you think that the Federal Reserve created $4 trillion to bail out the U.S. financial industry. So it may not seem like a big deal, except when you get to the point of saying, well, where does it all end? How does it all come out in the wash? How do they take out that government support? And the answer is, they don't. It never happens. It's a permanent change in the investment climate. And that's kind of my central theme. And in a way, it has many ramifications well beyond the financial field to have the government a permanent player in the financial markets. But there's no way mathematically that the government can withdraw their support and have the financial system stand on its own, which means, A, that interest rates are likely to stay down way longer than they should, and it doesn't really matter what's right or where interest rates should be. The beneficiaries of low interest rates are people who borrow, are the government themselves, are the banks whose cost of funds is almost nothing. Now, because the government is not really a very astute business player, along with the role that they play, they also play a dampening effect on the entrepreneurial or the risk-taking or the business-generating activity that can happen with bank funds. That's what I talked about at the beginning, is that there's very little effect in the real economy. And so what that's done, I don't know what the principle is. I'm sure there's a name for it. But the unintended consequence of that is that there are now whole sections of the lending function that banks don't perform. And they don't make a lot of commercial loans. They don't make any real estate loans to entrepreneurs, and that's one of the areas that we as a firm have stepped into. Not we haven't created the bank, but we are in touch with and invest in private lending. And the only reason that opportunity exists is because the banks are basically told, don't be in that business anymore. And so it's one of the few areas that have sort of fairly high consistent returns, not without risk, but it does have an opportunity to it to firms like ours. So the other, and I'll probably bring my sort of generic macro talk to a close here in a minute, and then just talk about some specific investment things, and then open it up to questions. One of the most troubling and important aspects, and again, this is something that I've been talking about with people during my travels, is if the government is the major player in the financial markets, and I see that every day when I look at my Bloomberg screen and I watch the movement of the markets have a not so invisible hand basically supporting it so it doesn't go down too much, and sort of tempering any kind of unsettling news. And it's just mind-boggling that there are forces at work that the individual investor can have no clue of, and we will never know what is going on behind the scenes in the financial markets, even in the trading activity in stocks on a daily basis. There's lots of examples of the exchanges technology breaking down, but basically the technology of the government, and this in the public realm, the public hears about it in terms of the NSA and all of those kind of privacy issues in terms of email or phone communication records and whatever that means. That same kind of government ability to gather, analyze, and then do something, and I'm not a conspiracist. I don't think there's this, you know, there's a plan to do anything in particular behind it. There's probably very well-intentioned people who are trying to keep the markets calm or whatever, or keep, you know, terrorists from striking so they listen into, you know, our private calls that they don't listen in, but they can track them and keep records of them. But that the ability of the individual investor to operate in a fair environment with good information is declining rapidly, and it's a very disturbing phenomena to me and to other people. Perhaps as much so as the whole privacy thing in the wireless industry is, I don't know. But our central challenge then to sort of bring it all back to the investing world is to say, okay, if we are going to live in a low interest rate environment with the invisible hand of the government impacting how the markets work, and what the banks are allowed to do, and the statistics that we get on employment or on economic activity are not reliable, how do we invest in that kind of environment? And, you know, the typical answer is diversification, which is fine, but people think, well, I have a mutual fund or five mutual funds, and that's diversification. Well, it's not. All of the U.S. stock funds essentially are interchangeable. There may be some that outperform others in one particular year. Or even diversifying in European stock funds as opposed to U.S. stock funds. Well, that's not really diversification anymore either, because the correlation or the way that these things go up and down now is basically in concert. The central banks have taken a very coordinated approach to funding the financial markets, and therefore the financial markets tend to go up and down together. So it's almost like we have to look outside of the box to see what kind of investing opportunities are there available. I talked a little bit about the private lending, I haven't really talked about, buying commercial real estate, and I think I won't talk about that this time. But basically, the use of financial instruments, even in the precious metals sector, where people bought gold through what are called exchange-traded funds or mutual funds, that whole market is very, very different than the actual real market for gold, for actual gold stuff, trinkets, or gold coins. The demand for gold is very, very strong in Asia and China and India. And some central banks are quietly stockpiling gold. But the price of gold on the financial markets is way down. It's down 30% or so. And so I guess in looking to diversify into an area like gold or real estate, because previously people could buy companies that invested in real estate and feel like they were diversified against the stock market going up and down, that these things would have a different economic cycle. But they don't anymore, because all forms of securities tend to travel together, and they don't travel necessarily in direct relationship to what's going on with the underlying asset. because the price of buying a real thing of gold is up, but the price of gold on the exchanges is down. And that means for us as investors that we have to do more work. We have to sort of get our hands dirtier than we used to, where you could sit at your computer screen and punch up stocks or index funds or mutual funds and feel like you've done your job. You've done your analysis work on the computer. You've got a diversified program. You've put into place it's all neat and tidy. And that just ain't the case anymore, because buying real estate in securities forms just doesn't do it. You don't get the returns. You don't get the protections. And the same thing is true for various kinds of new stocks. So anyway, I apologize if that's a little bit too much rambling. Maybe we're at about 40 minutes here. Maybe I can see if there are any questions in the radio audience.
One question. This past week there was the transition from Bernanke to Yeltsin, and it was hardly noted. Did that deserve any more attention than that?
I don't think so. They're cut from the same cloth. Their goal is the same. She was very well groomed to try and convince the world that she's both going to have the mandate of increasing economic activity, decreasing unemployment, and protecting against inflation. Typically, traditionally, the central bank's job was to protect the value of the currency and to ensure that inflation and that politics didn't get involved in the markets and dictate what was going on. Of course, that's totally gone out the window now, pretty much everywhere, so that there really are no independent central banks anymore. There are no sort of protectors of the true value of the people's money. So I think she's, you know, super smart woman, you know, Ben Bernanke. This experiment that may be irreversible of the government playing the majority player role is just something that we're going to live with. It has you know, far-reaching ramifications for. It's essentially another arm of the government that's unelected, and in many ways trumps the power of the legislature or the executive branch. So we have this new player on the political scene that's not accountable, essentially, and you know, again, these are not bad people in by themselves. It's just the role that they've been thrust into because our political system is not functioning anymore. It's just not. Obviously, we have gridlock over any real issue that's in front of Congress, and the executive branch, you know, however much one might admire or disdain Obama, depending on who you are, clearly he's having almost no effect in this presidency. His signature, you know, health plan is sort of continuously under attack. And, you know, it's not, I've written some articles about the healthcare, and I don't need to digress, but it's almost as if the system is not functioning anymore. And so the power abhors a vacuum, and now there is a new power. And Janet Yellen is I almost want to say Boris Yeltsin, but it's not. I don't know why I've got that slip in there. But anyway, that's my response to that question. Anything of interest to anyone else, or something that I haven't covered that you'd like to see covered? Okay. Well, with that, I'll sign off, and I appreciate everyone calling in, and hope that this has been worthwhile to listen to. And if you think of questions later, just feel free to email me at rob.raccoon@raccoongroup.com. And thank you to anyone who's tuning into this later, and hopefully you've gotten a flavor for how we're thinking here at the Raccoon Group, and how we're looking both in and outside the box at investment portfolios. So, adieu, adieu, adieu.
Thanks.
Yep. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.